This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
As we've been watching the Donna Adelson trial and obviously making a lot of narcissistic observations about narcissistic behavior during this, one thing we've learned is that narcissists tend to make things about themselves, even when they're not about them. Harvey was another one of the prime examples in the sentencing of Donna Adelson, who made such out-of-touch comments when he came to give his victim impact statement, that it's really, I don't know, kind of breathtaking. You're sending an innocent person to prison. You have taken my wife and my life as well. And for what? This is not justice. This is vengeance, and it's wrong. Well, vengeance, there should be vengeance against someone who's conspired to kill your former son-in-law. It's how our system works. It's vengeance directed towards those who are perpetrators of crimes against others. And guess what? Your wife and your son happen to be. How about you, Harvey? What did you know about any of this? It's not a great idea when there's a lot of people circling and a lot of people looking at this under a microscope to raise your hand and go, look at me. And Harvey, you've been really good at shutting the F up for a long time and not saying much. And, you know, I don't think a lot of us had much of an opinion other than this is, you know, I actually thought he was more of the victim of his family than not. But I don't know that I feel that way after watching his speech in court the other day. What do you think? Tell me your comments and thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. Certainly, you're going to be upset. Your wife's going away for the rest of her natural life, and you're 81. You're about to kick off, too. I don't know if there's going to be any Harvey Donna conjugal visits in the future on this planet. So I get he's upset. But not upset that his grandkids, the people that he supposedly loves, lost their father. And then to go and further insult the actual family of the murder victim as well. That happened too. Anyway, I want to talk about the person in this story who hasn't been charged but keeps showing up in the receipts. Because you just put a giant target on your head, Harvey. You could have sailed off into the ether, maybe found some new love at the Villages. But then you went and opened your mouth. And then you made a lot of people, like me and others, who are digging deeper into this case go, You know, I was kind of looking over here, but I think we need to look over here a little bit more, too. And I think there's a lot of investigators, and I'm going to guess Georgia Kappelman knows a hell of a lot more than any of us do of what's still to come. Harvey, I should say, innocent, never been charged with anything. I'm obviously maintained his innocence yesterday and maintained the innocence of Donna yesterday as well. All a big witch hunt, right? Well, let's look further, shall we? Let's. The man who sat in the front row, who spoke up for his wife, who insists the system got it wrong, and yet his phone number, his movements, and his name keep resurfacing in the evidence and filings around the murder of Dan Markell. Weird. We're going to walk that line carefully and clearly because this isn't about being inflammatory. This is about what's in the record when you trace the timeline and ask the simple questions. What did Harvey Adelson likely know? And what does the evidence say about whether the state could ever bring a case against him? Should they? Could they? Will they? Let's set a fair anchor. As of today, Donna Adelson has been sentenced to life in prison for her role in the murder of her former son-in-law, Florida State Law Professor Dan Markell. She maintains she's innocent and intends to appeal, but the court sentence stands. In that same courthouse, Harvey spoke in her defense and presented the public face of a husband who believes his wife was wrongfully convicted. That moment matters because it's his posture, his insistence, and because it sits in sharp contrast to what we're going to walk through, the pieces of evidence and sworn testimony that bring his name back to the center of gravity around this crime. And here's a critical disclaimer up front. Harvey Adelson has not been charged with any crime. Neither has his daughter, Wendy. That is the state of play right now. From the beginning, this case has turned on two pillars, motive and movement. Motive shows up, unmistakably, in messages and calls. During Donna's trial, jurors were shown the 2014 of March messages in which Donna referred to arranging a birthday present for Harvey. Prosecutors argued that this was coded language for solving the problem that stood between Wendy and a relocation to South Florida with the children. The defense did not concede that interpretation. But you don't have to accept the code theory to understand why it matters. It identifies a beneficiary and centers Harvey in the family grievance, prosecutors said, at the heart of this plot. The point is not the cake, it's the context. Movement follows motive. In court, law enforcement mapped phone movements and call patterns around key events, including messages such as Donna's text to Charlie that she was outside your house around the time planning conversations were alleged to be taking place. That by itself is not a conviction. It's proximity. In conspiracy cases, proximity plus communication is often how prosecutors start building proof of agreement, not by a single dramatic quote, but by the way devices and people move and talk as plans take shape. The communication web is where Harvey's number draws the most attention. In trial testimony summarized by courtroom reporters, a law enforcement witness described call detail patterns in which a number attributed to Harvey appeared in contact with key figures in the investigation, including a man later convicted as one of the shooters. It's important to be precise here. Call detail records show connection between numbers, who called whom, when, and for how long. They do not reveal what was said. They don't tell you tone, purpose, or intent. When those arrows point from a number attributed to Harvey into the same small network that prosecutors said planned and carried out this murder, it becomes connective tissue a jury can feel as evidence. It doesn't answer every question. It sharpens them. As the years turned and more material surfaced in the court record, a second strand emerged. Wiretaps. Filings describing new taps on a phone attributed to Harvey and alleged conversations about harming other individuals. Those are allegations made in court papers. They were not findings by a jury. Wiretaps require a judge to be shown probable cause that criminal conduct is ongoing. A wire authorization isn't granted on a hunch. For our purposes, it proves two things. First, that investigators were still building around Harvey long after the original crime. Second, that prosecutors told a court they believed the phone in his pocket remained relevant to potential criminal activity. Allegation is not proof. The probable cause is not nothing either. Then there is money, the bloodstream of a conspiracy case. During pretrial proceedings, prosecutors stated that they had subpoenaed records for a Zelle account attributed to Harvey. In open court, a jail witness testified that Donna had said Harvey would send money by Zelle. That testimony was subject to cross-examination and credibility challenges, as any jailhouse account should be. But taken together, a subpoena for a peer-to-peer transfer and testimony invoking Harvey as a source of funds, those facts redirect attention from call logs to banking entries. Money is agnostic. It either moves or it doesn't. If it transfers, and if the transfers match the talk, you have something more than a story. You have a ledger. Those alleged payments did not sit in isolation. During Donna's trial, there was testimony from jailhouse witnesses describing Donna soliciting false testimony with suggestions of compensation attached. Again, juries are rightly skeptical of informants. Prosecutors know that and typically seek corroboration. This is why financial records can become pivotal. If money corroborates a claim, the evidentiary weight shifts from something said to something happened. And if those records tie to an account attributed to Harvey, whether as sender or as the person invoked as sender, that's a potential charging lane that runs alongside and separate from the original murder conspiracy. It's the language of obstruction and witness tampering, not just conspiracy. Again, all allegations. To keep this fair, let's pause on what call detail records and cell site analysis are and what they are not. A cell phone pings a tower. It does not take an oath. Call records establish that a connection happened between two devices at a certain time for a certain duration. That's it. So when prosecutors try to prove agreement, they build mosaics. Timing, volume, overlap with other events, travel data, contemporaneous texts, and where they can get it, the content of communications. In Donna's trial, law enforcement walked jurors through those layers, and that mapping placed family phones, including a number attributed to Harvey, inside a pattern the state says aligns with planning and aftermath. Defense counsel pushed back, and that's how it should work. The jury concluded the pattern mattered for Donna. Whether that pattern can be legally connected to Harvey in a way that survives reasonable doubt is the live question. There's also a moment outside the charts and timelines that is hard to ignore. Shortly after Charlie Adelson's conviction in 2023, Donna and Harvey were stopped on a jet bridge in Miami with one-way tickets to Vietnam. That stop culminated in Donna's arrest. No one charged Harvey with the crime because of that travel, but as behavior, it's the kind of fact prosecutors warehouse because it looks and feels like awareness that the walls are closing in. At trial, jurors heard recorded calls in which Donna discussed extradition and looking at places. Harvey's voice isn't on those audios that we've heard. His presence on the jet bridge, though, is a data point, one that doesn't prove guilt but does raise questions about state of mind. So what exactly would the law require if the state ever attempts to charge Harvey? Conspiracy is an agreement and an intent to commit a crime, often proven through an overt act by any member of the group. It is rarely established by a single sentence. It's proven by accumulation, communications that line up with travel and cash, coded language that a jury finds credible, and if the state can get it, a cooperator who says plainly he knew he agreed. Based on what's public, the strongest ties in that mosaic for Harvey are communication links to certain players, movements aligned with key dates, wiretap allegations that triggered judicial authorization, and subpoenas for financial records to see whether the money matches the claims. None of that is a conviction. All of it is the kind of material prosecutors evaluate when they ask, is this chargeable? There is another lane that doesn't require proving he joined the original agreement. Accessory after the fact or obstruction. If the state can show someone helped a principal avoid detection or attempted to influence testimony by words, money, or intermediaries, that conduct can be charged independently. The jailhouse testimony about offers of compensation is already in the transcript. The question is whether financial records corroborate it in any way that a jury would trust. That's not punditry, it's accounting. It's timestamps, sender, and receipt names, and whether the flow of funds lines up with the timing of the talk. Because we are committed to being fair about this. We also need to say out loud why a case against Harvey would be difficult. A phone number is not a fingerprint. Call logs do not tell you who physically held the device, nor do they reveal content. It's not to say that information isn't out there and that Georgia Kaplan may be sitting on it right now. But as of our knowledge, that's what we know, is this. Jailhouse testimony is historically fraught and requires caution. Courts warn juries about it for a reason. And there's the simple fact that even after Charlie's conviction and Donna's sentence, the state has not filed charges against Harvey. That either means investigators are continuing to build or that what they have right now does not meet their standard. Those are both legitimate possibilities. The absence of a charge is not an exoneration, but it is a fact that matters. There's also the question of compelled testimony. In the lead-up to Charlie's trial, prosecutors sought to compel Donna and Harvey to answer questions under state law. The parents did not ultimately take the stand. The Fifth Amendment exists for a reason. And any competent defense lawyer would have advised caution in a criminal orbit as complicated as this one. From the public's perspective, though, the takeaway is straightforward. Investigators have been trying to pin down Harvey's account for years. That account remains largely off the record. You'll sometimes hear the phrase unindicted co-conspirator in public reporting around this case. It's important to define terms. Unindicted co-conspirator is not a charge and it's not a conviction. It's a label that can appear in filings to describe someone as a prosecutor believes participated in a conspiracy, but who was not being charged at that time. Whether and how that phrase has been used in this case over time, it does not change the bottom line. Harvey Adelson has not been indicted. That is the language that matters for legal status. So where does that leave us? If we insist on a standard that is both reasonable and real, it leaves us with a simple, sober threshold. Charge him if and only if the state can produce one of three things. First, communication content tying him directly to the planning or payment. Second, a cooperator with credibility who places him inside the agreement and whose account is corroborated by independent evidence. Third, financial records that prove witness tampering or obstruction, regardless of whether he joined the original murder plan. Those are the kinds of receipts that survive cross-examination and reasonable doubt. They're also the kind that turn public suspicion into a prosecutable case. Harvey's defenders will say the state had constructed a villain out of a husband and a father whose family was torn apart by a grinding custody dispute and a staggering crime, that his number shows up in logs because everyone involved occupied the same circle, and that his name gets pulled into new allegations because people instinctively want a neat, complete narrative. His statement in court supporting Donna's innocence and criticizing the process fits that defense. The counterpoint is not a theory, it's a list of things that are actually in the record. The birthday present language that the prosecutor said was code and a jury credited in context, the call detail patterns that place a number attributed to Harvey inside the same web as the convicted trigger man and other subjects, the wiretaps authorized by a judge based on probable cause, and the subpoenas for Zelle records along with testimony invoking Harvey as the person who would move money. Some of those facts are allegations. Some are testimony, some are legal steps with defined standards, but all of them are entries on a real timeline. If you're feeling the tension in this story, that's because it sits right at the seam between the, we can see the outline and we can prove it in court. We don't have transcripts of every call. We don't have an admission. What we have is a pattern prosecutors have already used to convict others. Motive knotted to a family objective, communications aligning with traveling cash, coded language that a jury accepted as code, and now a life sentence for the matriarch. Inside that pattern, Harvey isn't a footnote. He's a figure who keeps reappearing. Whether that reappearance becomes a charge is not a matter of vibes or outrage. It's a matter of evidence that meets a legal threshold. So the takeaway is this. Disciplined and simple. The justice system is supposed to be about proof, not emotion. But accountability starts before an arrest. It starts when we read the record with both eyes open, when we refuse to ignore the inconvenient parts, and we refuse to leap to conclusions that feel emotionally satisfying but aren't supported by evidence. In the Markell case, the court has spoken loudly about some of the players, and Harvey? Law's quiet. The receipts are not. If the state can match talk to transfers and calls to content, charge him. If not, the label that matters, unindicted, remains the only honest one to use. In a case that's already taken so much from so many, honesty is a discipline we cannot afford to not be in control of. It needs to be in control, no matter how much, no matter how out of touch, how crazy his statement was the other day in court. He is entitled to his opinion. And he may 1,000% believe it. We don't know the dynamics of that relationship, of that house, of what was going on. We could be in a world where he is just as bamboozled as many others. Just as not connected to the reality of this story as one should be, because everybody sees things through their own prism. I'm not trying to stick up for Harvey Adelson. I'm just saying, look at it from all perspectives. And that can explain behavior. Doesn't excuse it, doesn't make it right, but again, it can explain it. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us. Let me know your thoughts. And press subscribe while you're there as well, whether you're listening to us on the podcast platforms or on YouTube. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.